Rosie and Belinda returned to the living room at the same time as Eamon with his doctor's bag. Belinda reasonably deduced that there was some medical problem, but Eamon explained about the genographic project. Belinda was a nurse, and she took the blood with professional expertise. As I handed the filled tube to Rosie to put in her handbag, I noticed her hands were shaking. I diagnosed anxiety, presumably related to the imminent confirmation of her paternity. I was not surprised when she asked, only seconds after leaving the Hughes' residence, if we could process the DNA sample immediately. It would require opening the lab on a Saturday evening, but at least the project would be completed. The laboratory was empty. Throughout the university, the archaic idea of working Monday to Friday results in an incredible underutilization of expensive facilities. The university was trialing analysis equipment that could test for parent-child relationships very quickly, and we had an ideal DNA sample. It is possible to extract DNA from a wide variety of sources, and only a few cells are needed for an analysis, but the preparatory work can be time-consuming and complex. Blood was easy. The new machine was located in a small room that had once been a tea room with sink and refrigerator. For a moment, I wished it had been more impressive, an unusual intrusion of ego into my thoughts. I unlocked the refrigerator and opened a beer. Rosie coughed loudly. I recognized the code and opened one for her also. I tried to explain the process to Rosie as I set up, but she seemed unable to stop talking, even as she used the scraper on her inner cheek to provide me with her DNA sample. I can't believe it's this easy, this quick. I think I've always known at some level. He used to bring me stuff when I was a kid. It's a vastly overspecified machine for such a trivial task. One time he brought me a chess set. Phil gave me girly stuff, jewelry boxes and shit. Pretty weird for a personal trainer when you think about it. You play chess? I asked. Not really. That's not the point. He respected that I have a brain. He and Belinda never had any kids of their own. I have a sense that he was always around. He might even have been my mum's best friend. But I've never consciously thought of him as my father. He's not, I said. The result had come up on the computer screen. Job complete. I began packing up. Wow, said Rosie. Ever thought of being a grief counsellor? No. I considered a number of careers, but all in the sciences. My interpersonal skills are not strong. Rosie burst out laughing. You're about to get a crash course in advanced grief counselling. It turned out that Rosie was making a sort of joke, as her approach to grief counselling was based entirely on the administration of alcohol. We went to Jimmy Watson's on Lygon Street, a short walk away, and as usual, even on a weekend, it was full of academics. We sat at the bar, and I was surprised to find that Rosie, a professional server of drinks, had a very poor knowledge of wine. A few years ago, Jean suggested that wine was the perfect topic for safe conversation, and I did some research. I was familiar with the backgrounds of the wines offered regularly at this bar. We drank quite a lot. Rosie had to go outside for a few minutes due to her nicotine addiction. The timing was fortunate, as a couple emerged from the courtyard and passed the bar. The man was Jean. The woman was not Claudia, but I recognized her. It was Olivia, the Indian vegetarian from Table for Eight. Neither saw me, and they went past too quickly for me to say anything. My confusion at seeing them together must have contributed to my next decision. A waiter came up to me and said, "There's a table for two that's just come free in the courtyard. Are you eating with us?" I nodded. I would have to freeze the day's market purchases for the following Saturday with the resulting loss of nutrients. Instinct had again displaced logic. Rosie's reaction to finding a table being set for us on her return appeared to be positive. Doubtless she was hungry, but it was reassuring to know that I had not committed a faux pas, always more likely when different genders are involved. The food was excellent. We had freshly shucked oysters, sustainable, tuna sashimi, selected by Rosie and probably not sustainable, eggplant and mozzarella stack, Rosie, veal sweetbreads, me, cheese shared, and a single serve of passion fruit mousse, divided and shared. I ordered a bottle of Marzan, and it was an excellent accompaniment. Rosie spent much of the meal trying to explain why she wanted to locate her biological father. I could see little reason for it. In the past, the knowledge might have been useful to determine the risk of genetically influenced diseases, but today Rosie could have her own DNA analyzed directly. Practically, her stepfather Phil seemed to have executed the father role, although Rosie had numerous complaints about his performance. He was an egotist. He was inconsistent in his attitude towards her. He was subject to mood swings. He was also strongly opposed to alcohol. I considered this to be a thoroughly defensible position, but it was a cause of friction between them. Rosie's motivation seemed to be emotional, and while I could not understand the psychology, it was clearly very important to her happiness. After Rosie had finished her mousse, she left the table to go to the bathroom. It gave me time to reflect, and I realized that I was in the process of completing a non-eventful and, in fact, highly enjoyable dinner with a woman, a significant achievement that I was looking forward to sharing with Jean and Claudia. I concluded that the lack of problems was due to three factors. One, I was in a familiar restaurant. It had never occurred to me to take a woman, or indeed anyone, to Jimmy Watson's, which I had only previously used as a source of wine. Two, Rosie was not a date. I had rejected her, comprehensively, as a potential partner, and we were together because of a joint project. It was like a meeting. Three, I was somewhat intoxicated, hence relaxed. As a result, I may have also been unaware of any social errors. At the end of the meal, I ordered two glasses of Sambuca and said, "Who do we test next?" Chapter 11. Besides Eamon Hughes, Rosie knew of only two other family friends from her mother's medical graduation class. It struck me as unlikely that someone who had illicit sex with her mother would remain in contact, given the presence of Phil. But there was an evolutionary argument that he would wish to ensure that the carrier of his genes was receiving proper care. Essentially, this was Rosie's argument also. The first candidate was Dr. Peter Endicott, who lived locally. The other, Alan McPhee, had died from prostate cancer, which was good news for Rosie, as lacking a prostate gland, she could not inherit it. Apparently, he had been an oncologist, but had not detected the cancer in himself, a not uncommon scenario. Humans often fail to see what is close to them and obvious to others. Fortunately, he had a daughter with whom Rosie had socialized when she was younger. Rosie arranged a meeting with Natalie in 3 days' time, ostensibly to view Natalie's newborn baby. I reverted to the normal schedule, but the father project kept intruding into my thoughts. I prepared for the DNA collection. I did not want a repeat of the broken cup problem. I also had another altercation with the dean as a result of the flounder incident. One of my tasks is to teach genetics to medical students. In the first class of the previous semester, a student who did not identify himself had raised his hand shortly after I showed my first slide. The slide is a brilliant and beautiful diagrammatic summary of evolution from single-cell organisms to today's incredible variety of life. Only my colleagues in the physics department can match the extraordinary story that it tells. I cannot comprehend why some people are more interested in the outcome of a football match or the weight of an actress. This student belonged to another category. "Professor Tillman, you used the word evolved." "Correct. I think you should point out that evolution is just a theory." This was not the first time I had received a question or statement of this kind. I knew from experience that I would not sway the student's views, which would inevitably be based on religious dogma. I could only ensure that the student was not taken seriously by other trainee doctors. "Correct," I replied, "but your use of the word just is misleading. Evolution is a theory supported by overwhelming evidence, like the germ theory of disease, for example. As a doctor, you will be expected to rely on science, unless you want to be a faith healer, in which case you are in the wrong course." There was some laughter. Faith healer objected. "I'm not talking about faith. I'm talking about creation science." There are only a few moans from the class. No doubt many of the students were from cultures where criticism of religion is not well tolerated, such as ours. I'd been forbidden to comment on religion after an earlier incident, but we were discussing science. I could have continued the argument, but I knew better than to be sidetracked by a student. My lectures are precisely timed to fit within 50 minutes. "Evolution is a theory," I said. "There is no other theory of the origins of life with wide acceptance by scientists or of any utility to medicine. Hence, we will assume it in this class." I believed I had handled the situation well, but I was annoyed that time had been insufficient to argue the case against the pseudoscience of creationism. Some weeks later, eating in the university club, I found a means of making the point succinctly. As I walked to the bar, I noticed one of the members eating a flounder, with its head still in place. After a slightly awkward conversation, I obtained the head and skeleton, which I wrapped and stored in my backpack. 4 days later, I had the class. I located Faith Healer and asked him a preliminary question. Do you believe that fish were created in their current forms by an intelligent designer? He seemed surprised at the question, perhaps because it had been 7 weeks since we had suspended the discussion. But he nodded in agreement. I unwrapped the flounder. It had acquired a strong smell, but medical students should be prepared to deal with unpleasant organic objects in the interests of learning. I indicated the head. Observe that the eyes are not symmetrical. In fact, the eyes are decomposed, but the location of the eye sockets was quite clear. This is because the flounder evolved from a conventional fish with eyes on opposite sides of the head. One eye slowly migrated around, but just far enough to function effectively. Evolution did not bother to tidy up. But surely an intelligent designer would not have created a fish with this imperfection. I gave Faith Healer the fish to enable him to examine it and continue the lecture. He waited until the beginning of the new teaching year to lodge his complaint. In my discussion with the dean, she implied that I had tried to humiliate Faith Healer, whereas my intent had been to advance an argument. Since he had used the term creation science, with no mention of religion, I made the case that I was not guilty of denigrating religion. I was merely contrasting one theory with another. He was welcome to bring counter-examples to class. "Don," she said, "as usual, you haven't technically broken any rules, but, how can I put it? If someone told me that a lecturer had brought a dead fish to class and given it to a student who had made a statement of religious faith, I would guess that the lecturer was you. Do you understand where I'm coming from? You're saying that I'm the person in the faculty most likely to act unconventionally, and you want me to act more conventionally. That seems an unreasonable request to make of a scientist. I just don't want you to upset people. Being upset and complaining because your theory is disproven is unscientific." The argument ended, once again, with the dean being unhappy with me, though I had not broken any rules, and me being reminded that I needed to try harder to fit in. As I left her office, her personal assistant, Regina, stopped me. "I don't think I have you down for the faculty ball yet, Professor Tillman. I think you're the only professor who hasn't bought tickets." Riding home, I was aware of a tightness in my chest and realized it was a physical response to the dean's advice. I knew that if I could not fit in a science department of a university, I could not fit in anywhere. Natalie McPhee, daughter of the late Dr. Alan McPhee, potential biological father of Rosie, lived 18 kilometres from the city, within riding distance, but Rosie decided we should travel by car. I was amazed to find that she drove a red Porsche convertible. "It's Phil's." "Your father's," I did the air quotes. "Yeah, he's in Thailand." "I thought he didn't like you, but he lent you his car." "That's the sort of thing he does. No love, just stuff." The Porsche would be the perfect vehicle to lend to someone you did not like. It was 17 years old, thus using old emissions technology, had appalling fuel economy, little legroom, high wind noise, and a non-functioning air conditioning system. Rosie confirmed my guess that it was unreliable and expensive to maintain. As we arrived at Natalie's, I realized I had spent the entire journey listing and elaborating on the deficiencies of the vehicle. I'd avoided small talk, but had not briefed Rosie on the DNA collection method. "Your task is to occupy her in conversation while I collect DNA. This would make best use of our respective skills." It soon became clear that my backup plan would be necessary. Natalie did not want to drink. She was abstaining from alcohol while breastfeeding her baby, and it was too late for coffee. These were reasonable choices, but we would not be able to swab a cup or glass. I deployed Plan B. "Can I see the baby?" "He's asleep," she said, "so you'll have to be quiet." I stood up, and so did she. "Just tell me where to go," I said. "I'll come with you." The more I insisted that I wanted to see the baby alone, the more she objected. We went to its room, and as she had predicted, it was sleeping. This was very annoying, as I had a number of plans that involved collecting DNA in a totally non-evasive way from the baby, who was, of course, also related to Alan McPhee. Unfortunately, I had not factored in the mother's protective instinct. Every time I found a reason to leave the room, Natalie followed me. It was very awkward. Finally, Rosie excused herself to go to the bathroom. Even if she had known what to do, she could not have visited the baby, as Natalie had positioned herself so that she could see the bedroom door and was checking frequently. "Have you heard about the genographic project?" I asked. She hadn't and was not interested. She changed the topic. "You seem very interested in babies." There was surely an opportunity here if I could find a way to exploit it. "I'm interested in their behaviour, without the corrupting influence of a parent present." She looked at me strangely. "Do you do any stuff with kids? I mean, scouts, church groups?" "No," I said. "It's unlikely that I'd be suitable." Rosie returned and the baby started crying. "Feeding time," said Natalie. "We should be going," said Rosie. Failure. Social skills had been the problem. With good social skills, I could surely have got to the baby. "I'm sorry," I said as we walked to Phil's ridiculous vehicle. "Don't be." Rosie reached into her handbag and pulled out a wad of hair. I cleaned her hairbrush for her. "We need roots," I said. But there was a lot of hair, so it was likely we would find a strand with its root attached. She reached into her bag again and retrieved a toothbrush. It took me a few moments to realize what this meant. "You stole a toothbrush?" "There was a spare in the cupboard. It was time for a new one." I was shocked at the theft, but we would now almost certainly have a usable sample of DNA. It was difficult not to be impressed by Rosie's resourcefulness, and if Natalie was not replacing her toothbrush at regular intervals, Rosie had done her a favour. Rosie did not want to analyse the hair or toothbrush immediately. She wanted to collect DNA from the final candidate and test the two samples together. This struck me as illogical. If Natalie's sample was a match, we would not need to collect further DNA. However, Rosie did not seem to grasp the concept of sequencing tasks to minimize cost and risk. After the problem with the baby access, we decided to collaborate on the most appropriate approach for Dr. Peter Endicott. "I'll tell him I'm thinking about studying medicine," she said. Dr. Endicott was now in the medical faculty at Deakin University. She would arrange to meet him over coffee, which would provide an opportunity to use the coffee cup swab procedure that currently had a 100% failure rate. I thought it unlikely that a barmaid could convince a professor that she had the credentials to study medicine. Rosie seemed insulted by this and argued that it did not matter in any case. We only had to persuade him to have a drink with us. A bigger problem was how to present me, as Rosie did not think she could do the job alone. "You're my boyfriend," she said. "You'll be financing my studies, so you're a stakeholder." She looked at me hard. "You don't need to overplay it." On a Wednesday afternoon, with Jean covering a lecture for me in return for the Asperger's night, we travelled in Phil's toy car to Deakin University. I'd been there many times before for guest lectures and collaborative research. I even knew some researchers in the medical faculty, though not Peter Endicott. We met him at an outdoor cafe crowded with medical students back early from the summer break. Rosie was amazing. She spoke intelligently about medicine and even psychiatry, in which she said she hoped to specialise. She claimed to have an honours degree in behavioural science and postgraduate research experience. Peter seemed obsessed with the resemblance between Rosie and her mother, which was irrelevant for our purposes. 3 times he interrupted Rosie to remind her of their physical similarity, and I wondered if this might indicate some particular bond between him and Rosie's mother, and hence be a predictor of paternity. I looked, as I'd done in Eamon Hughes's living room, for any physical similarities between Rosie and her potential father, but could see nothing obvious. "That all sounds very positive, Rosie," said Peter. "I don't have anything to do with the selection process, at least officially." His wording appeared to imply the possibility of unofficial, and hence unethical, assistance. Was this a sign of nepotism and thus a clue that he was Rosie's father? "Your academic background is fine, but you'll have to do the GAMSAT," Peter turned to me, "the standard admission test for the MD program." "I did it last year," said Rosie. "I got 74. Peter looked hugely impressed. "You can walk into Harvard with that score. But we take other factors into account here, so if you do decide to apply, make sure you let me know." I hoped he never went for a drink at the Marquis of Queensbury. A waiter brought the bill. As he went to take Peter's cup, I automatically put my hand on it to stop him. The waiter looked at me extremely unpleasantly and snatched it away. I watched as he took it to a cart and added it to a tray of crockery. Peter looked at his phone. "I'll have to go," he said, "but now that you've made contact, stay in touch." As Peter left, I could see the waiter looking towards the cart. "You need to distract him," I said. "Just get the cup. said Rosie. I walked towards the cart. The waiter was watching me, but just as I reached the tray, he snapped his head in Rosie's direction and began walking quickly towards her. I grabbed the cup. We met at the car, which was parked some distance away. The walk gave me time to process the fact that I had, under pressure to achieve a goal, been guilty of theft. Should I send a check to the cafe? What was a cup worth? Cups were broken all the time, but by random events. If everyone stole cups, the cafe would probably become financially non-viable. Did you get the cup? I held it up. Is it the right one? She said. I'm not good at non-verbal communication, but I believe I managed to convey the fact that while I might be a petty thief, I do not make errors of observation. Did you pay the bill? I asked. That's how I distracted him. By paying the bill? No, you pay at the counter. I just took off. We have to go back. Fuck him, said Rosie, as we climbed into the Porsche and sped off. What was happening to me? Chapter 12. We drove towards the university and the lab. The father project would soon be over. The weather was warm, though there were dark clouds on the horizon, and Rosie lowered the convertible roof. I was mulling over the theft. You still obsessing over the bill, Don? Rosie shouted over the wind noise. You're hilarious. We're stealing DNA, and you're worried about a cup of coffee. It's not illegal to take DNA samples, I shouted back. This was true, although in the UK we would have been in violation of the Human Tissue Act of 2004. We should go back. Highly inefficient use of time, said Rosie in a strange voice, as we pulled up to traffic lights and were briefly able to communicate properly. She laughed, and I realized she had been imitating me. Her statement was correct, but there was a moral question involved, and acting morally should override other issues. Relax, she said. It's a beautiful day. We're going to find out who my father is, and I'll put a check in the mail for the coffee. Promise. She looked at me. Do you know how to relax? How to just have fun? It was too complex a question to answer over the wind noise as we pulled away from the lights. And the pursuit of fun does not lead to overall contentment. Studies have shown this consistently. You missed the exit, I said. Correct, she replied in a joke voice. We're going to the beach. She spoke right over the top of my protest. Can't hear you, can't hear you. Then she put on some music, very loud rock music. Now she really couldn't hear me. I was being kidnapped. We drove for 94 minutes. I could not see the speedometer and was not accustomed to travelling in an open vehicle, but I estimated that we were consistently exceeding the speed limit. Discordant sound, wind, risk of death. I tried to assume the mental state that I used at the dentist. Finally, we stopped in a beachside car park. It was almost empty on a weekday afternoon. Rosie looked at me. Smile. We're going for a walk. Then we're going to the lab, and then I'm going to take you home. And you'll never see me again. Can't we just go home now? I said, and realized that I sounded like a child. I reminded myself that I was an adult male, 10 years older, and more experienced than the person with me, and that there must be a purpose for what she was doing. I asked what it was. I'm about to find out who my dad is. I need to clear my head. So can we walk for half an hour or so, and can you just pretend to be a regular human being and listen to me? I was not sure how well I could imitate a regular human being, but I agreed to the walk. It was obvious that Rosie was confused by emotions, and I respected her attempt to overcome them. As it turned out, she hardly spoke at all. This made the walk quite pleasant. It was virtually the same as walking alone. As we approached the car on our return, Rosie asked, "What music do you like?" "Why?" "You didn't like what I was playing on the drive down, did you?" "Correct." "So, your turn going back, but I don't have any bark." "I don't really listen to music," I said. "The bark was an experiment that didn't work." "You can't go through life not listening to music."
"I just don't pay any attention. I prefer to listen to information."
There was a long silence. We'd reached the car.
"Did your parents listen to music? Brothers and sisters?"
"My parents listened to rock music, primarily my father, from the era in which he was young." We got in the car and Rosie lowered the roof again. She played with her iPhone, which she was using as the music source. "Blast from the past," she said, and activated the music.
I was just settling into the dentist's chair again when I realized the accuracy of Rosie's words. I knew this music. It had been in the background when I was growing up. I was suddenly taken back to my room, door closed, writing in BASIC on my early generation computer, the song in the background. I know this song. Rosie laughed. If you didn't, that'd be the final proof that you're from Mars. Hurtling back to town in a red Porsche driven by a beautiful woman with the song playing, I had the sense of standing on the brink of another world. I recognized the feeling, which, if anything, became stronger as the rain started falling and the convertible roof malfunctioned, so we were unable to raise it. It was the same feeling that I had experienced looking over the city after the balcony meal, and again after Rosie had written down her phone number. Another world. Another life. Proximate but inaccessible. The elusive satisfaction. It was dark when we arrived back at the university. We were both wet. With the aid of the instruction manual, I was able to close the car roof manually. In the lab, I opened two beers, no cough signal required, and Rosie tapped her bottle against mine. Cheers, she said. Well done. You promised to send a check to the cafe. Whatever, promised. Good. You were brilliant, I said. I had been meaning to convey this for some time. Rosie's performance as an aspiring medical student had been very impressive. But why did you claim such a high score on the medical admission test? Why do you think? I explained that if I could have deduced the answer, I would not have asked. Because I didn't want to look stupid. To your potential father. Yeah, to him, to anybody. I'm getting a bit sick of certain people thinking I'm stupid. I consider you remarkably intelligent. Don't say it. Say what? For a barmaid. You were going to say that, weren't you? Rosie had predicted correctly. My mother was a doctor, so is my father, if you're talking about genes. You don't have to be a professor to be smart. I saw your face when I said I got 74 on the GAMSAT. You were thinking, he won't believe this woman's that smart. But he did. So, put your prejudices away. It was a reasonable criticism. I had little contact with people outside academia, and had formed my assumptions about the rest of the world primarily from watching films and television as a child. I recognized that the characters in Lost in Space and Star Trek were probably not representative of humans in general. Certainly, Rosie did not conform to my barmaid stereotype. It was quite likely that many of my other assumptions about people were wrong. This was no surprise. The DNA analyzer was ready. Do you have a preference? I asked. Whichever. I don't want to make any decisions. I realized that she was referring to the sequence of testing rather than the choice of father. I clarified the question. I don't know, she said. I've been thinking about it all afternoon. Alan's dead, which would suck. And Natalie would be my sister, which I've got to tell you is pretty weird. But it's sort of closure, if that makes sense. I like Peter, but I don't really know anything about him. He's probably got a family. It struck me once again that this father project had not been well thought through. Rosie had spent the afternoon trying to subdue unwanted emotions, yet the motivation for the project seemed to be entirely emotional. I tested Peter Endicott first, as the hair from Natalie's brush required more time for pre-processing. No match. I'd found several roots in the wad of hair, so there was no need to have stolen the toothbrush. As I processed them, I reflected that Rosie's first two candidates, including the one she had felt was a high probability, Eamon Hughes, had not matched. It was my prediction that Alan's daughter would not match either. I was right. I remembered to look at Rosie for her reaction. She looked very sad. It seemed we would have to get drunk again. Remember, she said, the sample's not from him, it's his daughter's. I've already factored it in. Naturally. So that's it. But we haven't solved the problem. As a scientist, I'm not accustomed to abandoning difficult problems. We're not going to, said Rosie. We've tested everyone I've ever heard of. Difficulties are inevitable, I said. Major projects require persistence. Save it for something that matters to you. Why do we focus on certain things at the expense of others? We will risk our lives to save a person from drowning, yet not make a donation that could save dozens of children from starvation. We install solar panels when their impact on CO2 emissions is minimal, and indeed may have a net negative effect if manufacturing and installation are taken into account,
rather than contributing to more efficient infrastructure projects. I consider my own decision-making in these areas to be more rational than that of most people, but I also make errors of the same kind. We are genetically programmed to react to stimuli in our immediate vicinity. Responding to complex issues that we cannot perceive directly requires the application of reasoning, which is less powerful than instinct. This seemed to be the most likely explanation for my continued interest in the Father Project. Rationally, there were more important uses for my research capabilities, but instinctively I was driven to assist Rosie with her more immediate problem. As we drank a glass of muddy water Pinot Noir at Jimmy Watson's before Rosie had to go to work, I tried to persuade her to continue with the project, but she argued, rationally enough, that there was now no reason to consider any member of her mother's graduation class more likely than any other. She guessed that there would be 100 or more students and pointed out that 30 years ago, as a result of entrenched gender bias, the majority would be male. The logistics of finding and testing 50 doctors, many of whom would be living in other cities or countries, would be prohibitive. Rosie said she didn't care that much. Rosie offered me a lift home, but I decided to stay and drink.
Chapter 13. Before abandoning the Father Project, I decided to check Rosie's estimate of the number of father candidates. It occurred to me that some possibilities could be easily eliminated. The medical classes I teach contain numerous foreign students. Given Rosie's distinctly pale skin, I considered it unlikely that her father was Chinese, Vietnamese, Black, or Indian. I began with some basic research, an internet search for information about the medical graduation class, based on the three names I knew. The results exceeded my expectations, but problem-solving often requires an element of luck. It was no surprise that Rosie's mother had graduated from my current university. At the time, there were only two medical courses in Melbourne. I found two relevant photos. One was a formal photo of the entire graduation class with the names of the 146 students. The other was taken at the graduation party, also with names. There were only 124 faces, presumably because some students did not attend. Since the gene shopping had occurred at the party, or after, we would not have to worry about the non-attendees. I verified that the 124 were a subset of the 146. I had expected that my search would produce a list of graduates and probably a photo. An unexpected bonus was a "Where are they now?" discussion board. But the major stroke of luck was the information that a 30th anniversary reunion had been scheduled. The date was only 3 weeks away. We would need to act quickly. I ate dinner at home and rode to the Marquis of Queensbury. Disaster. Rosie wasn't working. The barman informed me that Rosie worked only 3 nights per week, which struck me as insufficient to provide an adequate income. Perhaps she had a day job as well. I knew very little about her, beyond her job, her interest in finding her father and her age, which, based on her mother's graduation party being 30 years earlier, must be 29. I had not asked Jean how he had met her. I did not even know her mother's name to identify her in the photo. The barman was friendly, so I ordered a beer and some nuts and reviewed the notes I had brought. There were 63 males in the graduation party photo, a margin of only 2 over the females, insufficient to support Rosie's claim of discrimination. Some were unambiguously non-Caucasian, though not as many as I expected. It was 30 years ago, and the influx of Chinese students had not yet commenced. There was still a large number of candidates, but the reunion offered an opportunity for batch processing. I had by now deduced that the Marquis of Queensbury was a gay bar. On the first visit, I had not observed the social interactions as I was too focused on finding Rosie and initiating the Father Project, but this time I was able to analyse my surroundings in more detail. I was reminded of the chess club that I belonged to when I was at school. People drawn together by a common interest. It was the only club I'd ever joined, excluding the university club, which was more of a dining facility. I did not have any gay friends, but this was related to my overall small number of friends rather than to any prejudice. Perhaps Rosie was gay. She worked in a gay bar, although the clients were all males. I asked the barman. He laughed. "Good luck with that one," he said.
It didn't answer the question, but he had moved on to serve another customer. As I finished lunch at the university club the following day, Jean walked in, accompanied by a woman I recognised from the singles party, Fabian, the sex-deprived researcher. It appeared that she had found a solution to her problem. We passed each other at the dining room entrance. Jean winked at me and said, "Don, this is Fabian. She's visiting from Belgium and we're going to discuss some options for collaboration." He winked again and quickly moved past. Belgium. I had assumed Fabian was French. Belgian explained it. Jean already had France. I was waiting outside the Marquis of Queensbury when Rosie opened the doors at 9 p.m. "Don," Rosie looked surprised, "is everything okay?" "I have some information. Better be quick." "It's not quick. There's quite a lot of detail." "I'm sorry, Don. My boss is here. I'll get into trouble. I need this job." "What time do you finish?" 3 a.m. I couldn't believe it. What sort of jobs did Rosie's patrons have? Maybe they all worked in bars that opened at 9 p.m. and had 4 nights a week off. A whole invisible nocturnal subculture using resources that would otherwise stand idle. I took a huge breath and a huge decision. "I'll meet you then." I rode home, went to bed, and set the alarm for 2:30 a.m. I cancelled the run I had scheduled with Jean for the following morning to retrieve an hour. I would also skip karate. At 2:50 a.m, I was riding through the inner suburbs. It was not a totally unpleasant experience. In fact, I could see major advantages for myself in working at night. Empty laboratories. No students. Faster response times on the network. No contact with the dean. If I could find a pure research position, with no teaching, it would be entirely feasible. Perhaps I could teach via video link at a university in another time zone. I arrived at Rosie's workplace at exactly 3 a.m. The door was locked, and a close sign was up. I knocked hard. Rosie came to the door. "I'm stuffed," she said. This was hardly surprising. "Come in. I'm almost done." Apparently the bar closed at 2:30 a.m, but Rosie had to clean up. "You want a beer?" she said. "A beer? At 3 a.m? Ridiculous." "Yes, please." I sat at the bar watching her clean up. The question I had asked sitting in the same place the previous day popped into my mind. "Are you gay?" I asked. "You came here to ask me that?" "No, the question is unrelated to the main purpose of my visit." "Pleased to hear it. Alone at 3 in the morning in a bar with a strange man." "I'm not strange." "Not much," she said, but she was laughing, presumably making a joke to herself based on the two meanings of strange. I still didn't have an answer to the gay question. She opened a beer for herself. I pulled out my folder and extracted the party photo. "Is this the party where your mother was impregnated?" "Shit, where did this come from?" I explained about my research and showed her my spreadsheet. All names are listed. 63 males, 19 obviously non-Caucasian, as determined by visual assessment and supported by names. 3 already eliminated. "You've got to be kidding. We're not testing 31 people. 41. Whatever. I don't have an excuse to meet any of them." I told her about the reunion. "Minor problem," said Rosie. "We're not invited." "Correct," I said. "The problem is minor and already solved. There will be alcohol." "So?" I indicated the bar and the collection of bottles on shelves behind it. "Your skills will be required." "You're kidding me. Can you secure employment at the event?" Hang on. This is getting seriously crazy. You think we're going to turn up at this party and start swabbing people's glasses? Oh, man. Not us. You. I don't have the skills, but otherwise, correct." "Forget it. I thought you wanted to know who your father was." "I told you," she said. "Not that much." 2 days later, Rosie appeared at my apartment. It was 8:47 p.m. and I was cleaning the bathroom as Eva, the short-skirted cleaner, had cancelled due to illness. I buzzed her upstairs. I was wearing my bathroom cleaning costume of shorts, surgical boots and gloves, but no shirt. "Wow," she stared at me for a few moments. "This is what martial arts training does, is it?" She appeared to be referring to my pectoral muscles. Then, suddenly, she jumped up and down like a child. "We got the gig! I found the agency and I offered them shit rates and they went, yeah, don't tell anyone."
I'll report them to the union when it's over. I thought you didn't want to do this.
Change my mind.
She gave me a stained paperback. Memorize this. I've got to get to work. She turned and left. I looked at the book. The Bartender's Companion, a complete guide to making and serving drinks. It appeared to specify the duties of the role I was to perform. I memorized the first few recipes before finishing the bathroom. As I prepared for sleep, having skipped the Aikido routine to spend further time studying the book, it occurred to me that things were getting crazy. It was not the first time that my life had become chaotic, and I had established a protocol for dealing with the problem and the consequent disturbance to rational thinking. I called Claudia. She was able to see me the next day. Because I'm not officially one of her clients, we have to have our discussions over coffee rather than in her office. And I'm the one accused of rigidity. I outlined the situation, omitting the father project component, as I did not want to admit to the surreptitious collection of DNA, which Claudia was likely to consider unethical. Instead, I suggested that Rosie and I had a common interest in movies.
"Have you talked to Jean about her?" asked Claudia.
I told her that Jean had introduced Rosie as a candidate for the wife project, and that he would only encourage me to have sex with her. I explained that Rosie was totally unsuitable as a partner, but was presumably under the illusion that I was interested in her on that basis. Perhaps she thought that our common interest was an excuse for pursuing her. I had made a major social error in asking her about her sexual orientation. It would only reinforce that impression. Yet Rosie had never mentioned the wife project. We had been sidetracked so quickly by the jacket incident, and after that things had unfolded in a totally unplanned way. But I saw a risk that at some point I would hurt her feelings by telling her that she had been eliminated from consideration for the wife project after the first date.
"So that's what you're worried about," said Claudia.
"Hurting her feelings."
"Correct."
"That's excellent, Don." "Incorrect. It's a major problem. I mean, that you're concerned about her feelings.
And you're enjoying time together?"
"Immensely," I said, realizing it for the first time.
"And is she enjoying herself?"
"Presumably, but she applied for the wife project."
"Don't worry about it," said Claudia. "She sounds pretty resilient. Just have some fun."
A strange thing happened the next day. For the first time ever, Jean made an appointment to see me in his office. I had always been the one to organize conversations, but there had been an unusually long gap as a result of the father project. Jean's office is larger than mine, due to his higher status rather than any actual requirement for space. The beautiful Helena let me in, as Jean was late in returning from a meeting. I took the opportunity to check his world map for pins in India and Belgium. I was fairly certain that the Indian one had been there before, but it was possible that Olivia was not actually Indian. She had said she was Hindu, so she could have been Balinese or Fijian, or indeed from any country with a Hindu population. Jean worked on nationalities rather than ethnicities, in the same way that travellers count the countries they have visited. North Korea, predictably, remained without a pin. Jean arrived and commanded the beautiful Helena to fetch us coffees. We sat at his table as if in a meeting.
"So," said Jean, "you've been talking to Claudia."
This was one of the negatives of not being an official client of Claudia. I did not have the protection of confidentiality.
"I gather you've been seeing Rosie," as the expert predicted.
"Yes," I said, "but not for the wife project. Jean is my best friend, but I still felt uncomfortable about sharing information about the father project. Fortunately, he did not pursue it, probably because he assumed I had sexual intentions towards Rosie. In fact, I was amazed that he didn't immediately raise the topic.
"What do you know about Rosie?" he asked.
"Not very much," I said honestly. "We haven't talked much about her. Our discussion has focused on external issues."
"Give me a break," he said. "You know what she does, where she spends her time. She's a barmaid."
"Okay," said Jean, "that's all you know.
And she doesn't like her father."
Jean laughed for no obvious reason.
"I don't think he's Robinson Crusoe."
This seemed a ludicrous statement about Rosie's paternity until I recalled that the reference to the fictional shipwreck survivor could be used as a metaphorical phrase meaning not alone, or in this context, not alone in not being liked by Rosie.
Jean must have noticed my puzzled expression as I worked it out and elaborated. The list of men that Rosie likes is not a long one.
She's gay?
Might as well be, said Jean. Look at the way she dresses. Jean's comment seemed to refer to the type of costume she was wearing when she first appeared in my office. But she dressed conventionally for her bar work and, on our visits to collect DNA, had worn unexceptional jeans and tops. On the night of the jacket incident, she had been unconventional but extremely attractive. Perhaps she did not want to send out mating signals in the environment in which Jean had encountered her, presumably a bar or restaurant. Much of women's clothing is designed to enhance the sexual attraction in order to secure a mate. If Rosie was not looking for a mate, it seemed perfectly rational for her to dress otherwise. There were many things that I wanted to ask Jean about Rosie, but I suspected that asking would imply a level of interest that Jean would misinterpret. But there was one critical question. Why was she prepared to participate in the Wife Project? Jean hesitated a while.
Who knows, he said.
I don't think she's a lost cause, but just don't expect too much. She's got a lot of issues. Don't forget the rest of your life. Jean's advice was surprisingly perceptive. Did he know how much time I was spending with the cocktail book?
Chapter 14. My name is Don Tillman, and I am an alcoholic. I formed these words in my head, but I did not say them out loud. Not because I was drunk, which I was, but because it seemed that if I said them, they would be true, and I would have no choice but to follow the rational path, which was to stop drinking permanently. My intoxication was a result of the Father Project, specifically the need to gain competence as a drinks waiter. I had purchased a cocktail shaker, glasses, olives, lemons, a zester, and a substantial stock of liquor, as recommended in the bartender's companion, in order to master the mechanical component of cocktail making. It was surprisingly complex, and I'm not naturally a dexterous person. In fact, with the exception of rock climbing, which I have not practiced since I was a student, and martial arts, I am clumsy and incompetent at most forms of sport. The expertise in karate and aikido is the result of considerable practice over a long period. I practiced first for accuracy, then speed. At 11:07 p.m. I was exhausted and decided that it would be interesting to test the cocktails for quality. I made a classic martini, a vodka martini, a margarita, and a cocksucking cowboy. Cocktails noted by the book as being among the most popular. They were all excellent, and tasted far more different from one another than ice cream varieties. I had squeezed more lime juice than was required for the margarita, and made a second so as not to waste it. Research consistently shows that the risks to health outweigh the benefits of drinking alcohol. My argument is that the benefits to my mental health justify the risks. Alcohol seems to both calm me down and elevate my mood, a paradoxical but pleasant combination, and it reduces my discomfort in social situations. I generally manage my consumption carefully, scheduling 2 days abstinence per week, although the Father Project had caused this rule to be broken a number of times. My level of consumption does not of itself qualify me as an alcoholic. However, I suspect that my strong antipathy towards discontinuing it might do so. The mass DNA collection sub-project was proceeding satisfactorily, and I was working my way through the cocktail book at the required rate. Contrary to popular belief, alcohol does not destroy brain cells. As I prepared for bed, I felt a strong desire to telephone Rosie and report on progress. Logically, it was not necessary, and it is a waste of effort to report that a project is proceeding to plan, which should be the default assumption. Rationality prevailed. Just. Rosie and I met for coffee 28 minutes before the reunion function. To my first-class honours degree and PhD, I could now add a Responsible Service of Alcohol certificate. The exam had not been difficult. Rosie was already in server uniform and had brought a male equivalent for me. I picked it up early and washed it, she said. I didn't want a karate exhibition. She was obviously referring to the jacket incident, even though the martial art I had employed was aikido. I had prepared carefully for the DNA collection. Ziploc bags, tissues, and pre-printed adhesive labels with the names from the graduation photo.
Rosie insisted that we did not need to collect samples from those who had not attended the graduation party, so I crossed out their names. She seemed surprised that I had memorized them, but I was determined not to cause errors due to lack of knowledge. The reunion was held at a golf club, which seemed odd to me, but I discovered that the facilities were largely for eating and drinking rather than supporting the playing of golf. I also discovered that we were vastly overqualified. There were regular bar personnel who were responsible for preparing the drinks. Our job was merely to take orders, deliver drinks, and most importantly, collect the empty glasses. The hours spent in developing my drink-making skills had apparently been wasted. The guests began arriving, and I was given a tray of drinks to distribute. I immediately perceived a problem. No name tags. How would we identify the DNA sources? I managed to find Rosie, who had also realized the problem but had a solution, based on her knowledge of social behavior. Say to them, "Hi, I'm Don, and I'll be looking after you this evening, Dr. She demonstrated how to give the impression that the sentence was incomplete, encouraging them to contribute their name. Extraordinarily, it turned out to work 72.5% of the time. I realized that I needed to do this with the women as well, to avoid appearing sexist. Eamon Hughes and Peter Endicott, the candidates we had eliminated, arrived. As a family friend, Eamon must have known Rosie's profession, and she explained to him that I worked evenings to supplement my academic income. Rosie told Peter Endicott that she did bar work part-time to finance her PhD. Perhaps they both assumed that we had met through working together. Actually swabbing the glasses discreetly proved the most difficult problem, and I was able to get at most one sample from each tray that I returned to the bar. Rosie was having even more problems. "I can't keep track of all the names," she said frantically, as we passed each other with drinks trays in our hands. It was getting busy and she seemed a little emotional. I sometimes forget that many people are not familiar with basic techniques for remembering data. The success of the sub-project would be in my hands. "There will be adequate opportunity when they sit down," I said. "There is no reason for concern." I surveyed the table set for dinner, 10 seats per table, plus 2 with 11 seats, and calculated the attendance at 92. This, of course, included female doctors. Partners had not been invited. There was a small risk that Rosie's father was a transsexual. I made a mental note to check the women for signs of male features and test any that appeared doubtful. Overall, however, the numbers looked promising. When the guests sat down, the mode of service moved from provision of limited selection of drinks to taking orders. Apparently, this arrangement was unusual. Normally, we would just bring bottles of wine, beer, and water to the table. But as this was an upmarket function, the club was taking orders and we'd been told to push the top shelf stuff, apparently to increase the club's profits. It occurred to me that if I did this well, I might be forgiven for any other errors. I approached one of the tables of 11. I had already introduced myself to 7 of the guests and obtained 6 names. I commenced with a woman whose name I already knew. "Greetings, Dr. Collie. What can I get you to drink?" She looked at me strangely, and for a moment I thought I had made an error with the word association method I was using, and that her name was perhaps Doberman or Poodle. But she did not correct me. "Just a white wine, thanks." "I recommend a margarita, world's most popular cocktail."
"You're doing cocktails?"
"Correct."
"In that case," she said, "I'll have a martini."
"Standard?"
"Yes, thanks."
"Easy."
I turned to the unidentified man beside her and tried the Rosie name extraction trick. "Greetings. My name is Don, and I'll be looking after you this evening, Doctor."
"You said you're doing cocktails?"
"Correct."
"Have you heard of a Rob Roy?"
"Of course."
"Well, put me down for one."
"Sweet, dry, or perfect?" I asked. One of the men opposite my customer laughed.
"Cop that, Brian."
"Perfect," said the man I now knew as Dr. Brian Joyce.
There were 2 Brians, but I had already identified the first. Dr. Walsh, female, no transsexual characteristics, ordered a margarita.
"Standard, premium, strawberry, mango, melon, or sage and pineapple?" I asked.
"Sage and pineapple? Why not?"
My next customer was the only remaining unidentified man, the one who had laughed at Brian's order. He had previously failed to respond to the name extraction trick.
I decided not to repeat it. What would you like? I asked.
I'll have a double-coddled Kurdistani sailmaker with a reverse twist, he said. Shaken, not stirred.
I was unfamiliar with this drink, but assumed the professionals behind the bar would know it. Your name, please.
Sorry?
I require your name to avoid errors. There was a silence. Dr. Jenny Broadhurst, beside him, said, His name's Rod. Dr. Roderick Broadhurst, correct? I said by way of confirmation. The rule against partners did not apply, of course, to people who were in a relationship with someone from the same class. There were 7 such couples, and Jenny was predictably sitting beside her husband.
What?
Started Rod, but Jenny interrupted.
Quite correct. I'm Jenny, and I'll have a sage and pineapple margarita too, please.
She turned to Rod. Are you being a jerk about the sailmaker? Pick on someone with your own complement of synapses.
Rod looked at her, then at me.
Sorry, mate. Just taking the piss. I'll have a martini. Standard.
I collected the remainder of the names and orders without difficulty. I understood that Jenny had been trying to tell Rod discreetly that I was unintelligent, presumably because of my waiter role. She had used a neat social trick, which I noted for future use, but had made a factual error which Rod had not corrected. Perhaps one day he or she would make a clinical or research mistake as a result of this misunderstanding. Before I returned to the bar, I spoke to them again. There is no experimental evidence of a correlation between synapse numbers and intelligence level within primate populations. I recommend reading Williams and Herrop, Annual Review of Neuroscience. I hope this would be helpful. Back at the bar, the cocktail orders caused some confusion. Only one of the 3 bar persons knew how to make a Rob Roy, and then only a conventional one. I gave her the instructions for the perfect version. Then there was an ingredient problem with the sage and pineapple margarita. The bar had pineapple, tinned, the book had said fresh if possible, so I decided that this would be acceptable, but no sage. I headed for the kitchen where they could not even offer me dried sage. Obviously, this was not what the bartender's companion had called a well-stocked bar ready for any occasion. The kitchen staff were also busy, but we settled on coriander leaves and I took a quick mental inventory of the bar's ingredients to avoid further problems of this kind. Rosie was also taking orders. We had not yet progressed to the stage of collecting glasses, and some people seemed to be drinking quite slowly. I realized that our chances would be improved if there was a high turnover of drinks. Unfortunately, I was unable to encourage faster consumption, as I would be violating my duty as the holder of a Responsible Service of Alcohol certificate. I decided to take a middle ground by reminding them of some of the delicious cocktails available. As I took orders, I observed a change in the dynamic of the ecosystem, evidenced by Rosie looking annoyed as she came past me.
Table 5 won't let me take their order. They want to wait for you.
It appeared that almost everyone wanted cocktails rather than wine. No doubt the proprietors would be pleased with the profit results. Unfortunately, it appeared that staff numbers had been calculated on the basis that most orders would be for beer or wine, and the bar personnel were having trouble keeping up. Their knowledge of cocktails was surprisingly poor, and I was having to dictate recipes along with the orders. The solution to both problems was simple. Rosie went behind the bar to assist, while I took all the orders myself. A good memory was a huge asset, as I did not need to write anything down or process just one table at a time. I took orders for the whole room, then relayed them back to the bar at consistent intervals. If people needed time to think, I left them and returned rather than waiting. I was actually running rather than walking, and increased my word rate to the maximum that I considered comprehensible. The process was very efficient and seemed to be appreciated by the diners, who would occasionally applaud when I was able to propose a drink to meet a particular requirement or replay a table's orders when they were concerned that I might have misheard. People were finishing their drinks, and I found that I could swab 3 glasses between the dining room and the bar. The remainder I grouped together and indicated to Rosie as I left the tray on the bar, rapidly advising her of the owner's names. She seemed a little pressured. I was enjoying myself immensely. I had the presence of mind to check the cream supplies before dessert was served. Predictably, the quantity was insufficient for the number of cocktails I expected to sell to complement the mango mousse and sticky date pudding. Rosie headed for the kitchen to find more.
When I returned to the bar, one of the barmen called out to me, "I've got the boss on the phone. He's bringing cream. Do you need anything else?" I surveyed the shelves and made some predictions based on the 10 most popular dessert cocktails.